You've got Living Writers on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm T. Hetzel, and today I'm so happy to have Greg Schutz here in the studio, down Central Campus, University of Michigan. Greg, it's been a long time coming. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me, Tia. It's wonderful to be here.
Well, I'm super excited to have you here with your book of stories, your debut collection, Joy Riders. And we've got Reverend Andrew behind the glass. And thanks to the Rev for hopping in and for Jason to putting the Greg's song picks together for today's show. Greg, thanks for picking the music for today, too.
Oh, my pleasure.
And the songs that folks will hear today all have connections to the feel and of Joy Riders, like the stories inside.
Yeah, I think so. I think they have something to do with, as you put it, the feel, the emotional content. They are all songs that touch upon, I think, loneliness, that are still nonetheless big-hearted. And they're all songs, I think, that I found myself listening to at different times during the long period in which I was working on these stories.
Greg, you mentioned that. Like, this Joy Riders has been a long time in the making as a collection. These stories have been out in the world through the years, have won, because you've had residencies, they've been placed in journals. Joy Riders itself, I would be super remiss if I didn't say, is the winner of the 2024 Juniper Prize for Fiction. Congratulations.
It is. Thank you so much. Yes. The earliest one of these stories, the title story actually, was, I want to say, begun in the winter of 2007-2008 and then was published in 2009.
So it was while you were in the program.
I was on my Zell year, that third year fellowship.
So, full disclosure, everyone, Greg and I overlapped in the MFA program here, the Helen Zell writing program. And Greg, so that was pretty exciting then. So kind of this feeling of, is it a story that you had like the original idea rolling into the program and you worked on it, this particular like Joy Riders? Or was it one where it all came to you as you were riding in the Michigan roads or so?
Yeah, it actually did kind of come to me on the road that Joy Riders is a story that features two primary characters. There is an older veterinarian, a widower, who goes by Doc, which is what most of his customers, even friends, call him. And then there is a younger sheriff's deputy. My father is, in fact, a large animal veterinarian in North Carolina, or was at the time of this writing, was in North Carolina, like Doc. And one of the things I would occasionally do, both growing up as a child and then occasionally out and about and say home from college, would be to ride around with my father from farm to farm, right? It's the sort of operation where he has a truck with all the equipment and he drives around to, place calls at these farms. And at one of these calls that I got to witness, there was a horse that had been shot. And no telling who had done it or why. Dad was, he was able to, just dig out the bullet, clean it up. Everything was okay, right? But that question of, who does such a thing sort of stuck with me for a long time. And so I had, around that time, the winter of 2007-2008, I had the beginnings of a story, right, in which a veterinarian receives a call in the middle of the night about a horse that's been shot, and he's heading out, on that call. And along the way of writing that opening, I sort of discovered, right, it is how it feels that Doc was a widower, and that was sort of something that was ongoing in his life, that grief at this point. And yeah, I got to the point in the story where Doc was going to have a conversation with the sheriff's deputy who was there to investigate and take statements on what had happened. And I found myself unable to write that scene in a way that felt authentic. I couldn't even put my finger on what was wrong about the scene. It just I tried various variations of, I mean, what would they say to one another? How would they react? What was, what wasn't getting said? And nothing felt right. And so,
but yet the scene itself, you knew, was part of the unfolding the discovery.
When you say that, it strikes me, why didn't I just backtrack and move in a different direction? But you're right. I did. It felt like it belonged. It felt right in terms of sort of the overall architecture I could kind of imagine for the story. And yet, I couldn't get the scene right. And then this went on for some time. I was stuck, for at least a number of weeks on this scene. And one day I was at the Mr. Stadium laundromat, here in Ann Arbor on South Industrial, which was where I did my laundry once a week, on schedule.
And then would you go to Benny's, perhaps, for breakfast? Or
Never went to Benny's, and now that feels like a missed opportunity.
It's still there, Greg. It's one of the places that are still there.
Oh, excellent. Old Ann Arbor. And so, at some point, during the spin cycle, I don't want to work on this scene. I feel I must work on this scene. I decide just to see what would happen. I'm going to try this sort of writer exercise thing. I'm going to write the scene from the other character's point of view. I'm going to write from the point of view of the sheriff's deputy. And I started that, and it's hard to describe. It just unlocked something. Something just felt right. The scene worked when I was watching the conversation, when I was experiencing the conversation through the deputy's point of view instead of the veterinarian. And this was a really important moment for me, I think, as a writer. I remember, Tia, last year sometime you had the poet Keith Taylor on, and whom we love. Keith is wonderful. And he was describing an early poem that he had written, and he said that, I wish I could remember how he put it, something like it opened things up for me. Like it was the poem that had sort of, began things for him. And this was maybe the moment with that story where something opened up for me as a writer. It was, I think, one of the first times, if not the first time, that I made this conscious craft decision, this craft decision about point of view. And all of a sudden it had all of these, things thematically and emotionally sort of seemed to spin off from that craft decision in a way I hadn't anticipated. Suddenly the story began to become about the way these two characters didn't experience that night, that situation, the same way, the way they didn't quite connect, the way they misinterpreted one another. And then from there, the story seemed just to sort of, it fell open, right, all the way to the end. And that was probably the first time I had written start to finish, despite having been through the MFA program here at Michigan, the first time I had written start to finish a story that I knew when I finished it, it was done and I was proud of it. And so I could look at that story and I'd say, this is what it looks like. This is how it feels, right, to finish a story. And so it calibrated something for me that I've been sort of relying on, I think, a little bit ever since.
What an incredibly important epiphany.
Absolutely.
Like an experience that probably in the program in different times or earlier, even in your early writing life, where you hear about such things, or you think about, craft, and or you deconstruct other folks' stories, but you can't feel that feeling until it's yours.
Absolutely.
In the experience.
Yeah. And I came to the program, as you might remember, directly out of undergraduate. So I had just turned 22 when I entered the program. And so writing for me at that point, writing stories was this, and it still is when it works well, it was this wonderful form of play. And so I could play and I could produce sort of these wild, strange stories sort of playfully. I could, on the other hand, I could write exercises. I could craft something to specification. And I couldn't seem, it feels maybe in retrospect, I don't know if I would have described it this way then, but it seems like I couldn't bring those two modes of writing together until the story Joyriders.
And then, and once you had that feeling, like you said, Greg, you calibrated the stories to come, or they, then maybe the stories had a certain expectation of you.
I like that way of putting it. Yeah, that as will probably come up, I like to write by feel, right? By instinct, just to sort of wander my way forward through the story. And once I had actually done that to the exit from the story, successfully, I knew how it felt. I knew that it could be done. I think just in terms of confidence, it changed how I experienced my own process. It gave me confidence that my sort of messy and rather slow process actually was a process that could produce results that I felt proud of, that felt to me meaningful, like the kinds of stories I wanted to be writing, which I don't know that I'd produced before. Maybe a story that I would have said, this is the kind of story I want to write.
Because by the sounds of it, Greg, before you were very successful with writing things and stories. Well, you know, that's kind of what probably got you right to the program right after undergrad.
I think I could write wonderful sentences. And
you still can.
I hope so. Yes. No, I think so.
You still do.
But I don't know that I knew how to put those sentences in the service of sort of larger structures, larger meaning-making structures. And so, you know, I describe those earliest stories, like the ones that made up my graduate thesis, as kind of wild. And I, you know, in both, I think sort of the positive sense of that, they were full of energy, but also in the negative sense, in that they weren't able to channel that energy into a direction that really, I think, added up to much for the reader. And I could tell that as a reader long before I knew how to solve it as a writer.
Because then these stories are, because what my sense of it is that they feel like small spaces where big things are happening.
I like that.
And not all the things are maybe I'm naming as I go, but you feel it. And that's, I think, when you know the short story, is its true self.
Yeah. A way that I sometimes describe it to my students, the short story, is that it's like this sort of, you know, it's this magical box that you take the lid off the box, you go inside, and you realize that it contains, or it can contain, so much more than you think it ought to be able to contain. And so I love stories that feel that way, that feel like, yeah, this suitcase that you can just keep unpacking and unpacking and unpacking, and there's more and more of those characters' lives in that story. You can't believe how much of their lives have gotten into this story. And, you know, the authors that I maybe most admire as short story writers, Deborah Eisenberg, Mavis Gallant, right? These are writers who do that, whose stories have that sort of magical quality of being just enormous on the inside, even if they're only 15, 20 pages long.
How does this relationship with a short story that you've been in for like the last 15 years?
Yes.
How does that change how you feel about fiction, about the novel, or about writing longer?
That's a really good question. It's one I wish I had a different answer for, that I think I would like to be able to say that next, you know, now I'm working on a novel. But
do you have to? Why?
It does feel like there's pressure, for a writer to produce a novel. I anecdotally know a number of writers who were able to publish their short story collections because it was part of that two-book contract, you know, with a novel. It's one reason I feel so lucky that the University of Massachusetts Press, you know, took Joyriders as a one-off, as a book on its own.
And awarded it a prize.
And awarded it a prize, absolutely. Yeah, so I love the short story. I feel like I'm still just scratching the surface of the short story, and I love the pressure that it puts me under as a writer, that it puts the material of the story under by its size, right? That I am far from mastering the craft of the short story. It feels like there is a long and satisfying amount of work ahead of me with that particular form.
I love it. Okay. Today on Living Writers, Greg Schutz is here. His book of stories, Joyriders, out with the University of Massachusetts Press this last March. I'm T. Hetzel. We've got Reverend Andrew behind the glass, and we'll be back. Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, so glad you're here with us today on this beautiful spring afternoon, the last day of April,
I think.
The last day. And today, Greg Schutz is here in the studio here at WCBN-FM. And we've got the Rev behind the glass. And I'm T. Hetzel. And you're here listening and so glad. And the end of the semester is here. I guess we should acknowledge that, right, Greg?
It is. It's a celebratory time for those of us who teach, as it is for our students, I think.
It's true. Greg is there at the moment already, and I'm almost there. I'm almost there, too. But so exciting with graduation just around the corner.
And, absolutely.
And the beer pong tables out in full Packard glory on the way.
That's right. It's sort of like a bloom of sorts.
It is. It is. There are many kinds of blooms in Ann Arbor here. Today, the book on the table, Greg's book, Joyriders, Book of Stories. Before we get chatting again, I want to read Greg's short bio included on Joyriders. Greg Schutz's stories have appeared in numerous literary journals, including Plowshares, Story, and American Short Fiction, and have been listed among the Distinguished Stories of the Year by both Best American Short Stories and Best American Mystery Stories. Maybe I should have read the bio from your website, which is also awesome. And he lives in Ann Arbor.
In Chelsea now.
Oh, in Chelsea. Jeez, gosh, I keep trying to get Greg to... I'm like... You'd think I was a real estate agent, the way I've been pressuring you to move back to Ann Arbor,
and my
Greg.
My partner and I are always trying to get people to join us in Chelsea.
Well, I believe it. It sounds like it would be. It's such a lovely place. I think Laura Kay is there, I think. And
she is, yeah.
And so that's great. And your pup, Georgie, is there.
She is.
And yeah. And what kind of terrier is Georgie?
That is a very good question. Many
kinds. A mystery?
Yeah. A 25-pound mustachioed terrier.
Oh, wow. Okay. And is the mustachioed terrier, is that a breed, Greg?
I wish, because then I would know. I would know my favorite breed of dog. No, Georgie is one of a kind.
Oh, that's well. Then she's the best. I'm glad we have a one of a kind Hildy right now too.
Yes.
But I'm taking it you didn't do the DNA swab.
We
for
did
Georgie.
Not. We
that's,
did not.
Okay. Which is good. Like, why do you need to, right?
There's no recreating some dogs, right?
Exactly. I think we only did it because we're like, is she ever going to stop growing? So we were talking before the break about Joyriders and about part of like your passion for the short story, Greg, is the discovery, is the finding the way,
yes,
within the form itself, and what the world that it's creating. And I loved and was very interested in how you said it puts pressure on me as a writer and it puts pressure on the material itself.
It does. In often a kind of transformative way, right? There are just simply ways of approaching the material that will not work in the story form, right? Versus that more flexible, that more capacious form, like the novel, that, you know, what's the, was it Henry James who called the novel a loose, baggy monster?
That sounds, you know, great.
That's kind of the novel's superpower.
Maybe his novel. or a doorstop. No, just right, kidding. No, that's – I take it back.
But it can be as long as it needs to be, right?
Right.
That you can't write a novel that's so long that people no longer call it a novel. You can write a short story that is so long it is no longer a short story, that it's from word one, contending with the pressure of its own onrushing end. And that requires – I don't know, that requires, I think, a variety of really delicate and creative approaches to the material if you want, I think especially in terms of time, if you want more time to pass for your characters than passes for the reader as they are reading, then we need to find various ways of folding and layering time, which is something I think in a lot of the stories in Joy Riders I am trying to do, that looking for ways to, again, get more of that character's life, more of their history into the story.
Why is that a value for you, Greg? Because what does that do for your characters? Like, how does it build them out for you, or create them like as a full-hearted,
yes,
creature? So.
Well, I think it speaks to, I mean, it must, if these stories, right, if I'm feeling satisfied by them or proud of them, it must speak to some way I have of sort of seeing or parsing my own life. That one classic way, right, of dealing with the shortness of the short story is to compress and cut, right, to remove everything from the story that does not absolutely belong, right, to have a story in which, you know, it takes 15 minutes to read and about 15 minutes of time passes for the characters, right? Classic example would be something like Hemingway's Hills Like White Elephants. And I'm interested, I think, largely, you know, not to diss Hemingway, although he can take the hit. I'm interested in other strategies for how to approach the way life feels in a short story, because my own life, which is all I have to judge by, it doesn't accrue meaning in those kinds of bite-sized chunks. Things don't just sort of happen, you know, in this sort of compressed span, and during that span of time, things are only about this one meaning, and then I'm on to another meaning. That to the extent my life comes to mean things for me, it comes to mean based on how the present moment seems to resonate against various past moments, the way it connects to a variety of different memories, the way that these various memories underlay the present moment in a kind of strata. And then the ways that those various sorts of strata, they pattern off one another. And so I've, in these stories, been trying to discover, how do I get those patterns onto the page? How do I get that sort of that way of finding meaning and felt experience, that way of recognizing meaning in the present moment by how the present moment is rooted in all of these chronologically distant past moments? And how do I do that within the contained space of a short story?
And taking the reader with you, because some of those spinnings or those lines of memories or the past or the strata, because then you're moving the reader with you.
Absolutely. That ultimately, right, it's all there to offer the reader this single contained experience that I sometimes define, again, for my students, the short story, right? It's a narrative that's designed typically to be read in a single sitting, that by the end of the story, then everything that has happened in the story is kind of ringing in your ears at the same time, like a musical chord, right? That all these things ought to sort of be then sort of harmonizing with one another. And to my mind, I think that that's one reason the short story is really, really adept at getting at what it feels like to remember. Really good at getting at the feeling of memory, that it layers, if we layer time in a short story or layer different time frames atop one another, we get those time frames resonating together all in the reader's ear at once, because the reader has sort of experienced them in this single, this single go. And that feels to me that if my life ever comes to mean things, right, it is in that sort of way where I have this sense of certain parts of my past that are very alive in the present moment, that are very connected to the present moment.
I think it's so important how you were. I love that it's connected to the present moment and bringing that in for the character as well, the character's present moment.
Absolutely.
Right? It's interesting how you're saying like the story in a single reading or as itself, like where you're in the story and then it's ringing or resonating by the time you're in the last lines of the story. And I just always want everyone to give the stories that chance and yes. not like somehow be propelled into the next story in the collection. When you're putting together Joyriders, because you can't be a conductor, even though this is your composition, mm-hmm. right? In that way, or is that even a concern when you think how you have each of the stories working as neighbors? Because we may meet one character who then we see later on, several
Absolutely.
Stories down. But how do you do it? And what are some of your considerations?
Yes, yeah, I mean, I think. Ideally, or at least the way I read a story collection is sort of the way that I think Mavis Gallant in her foreword to her collected stories advises it, one at a time and then wait. Right? Stories can wait, as she puts it. But yeah, as you said, right, that isn't how everyone experiences a story collection. And even if they do, even if they give that little break between stories to allow that, you know, each story's sort of chord to resonate, right? That other story is still going to be there. It's going to be in their minds as they move on to the next story. So how these stories sort of connect to one another is important. With putting together Joyriders, it was another thing that was done a little bit by feel, although in this case I also had a really useful prompt in that a number of the stories in Joyriders are connected, right? I've mentioned Doc, the veterinarian, the widower, who is in the title story, that he appears in several other stories that we sort of follow him and we follow his daughter, Danny, through those first several years after the death of Doc's wife, Danny's mother. And we see them sort of growing together, growing apart, reaching for one another or pushing away over that period of time. So I knew I wanted to structure the collection around this larger story about Doc and Danny and to sort of place those stories periodically throughout the collection. And then it was a matter of thinking about these other stories, these unconnected one-off stories, and how they might sort of resonate against the particular Doc and Danny stories they were placed beside or were placed between, right? Do they get us maybe emotionally from the end point of one story to something close to where the next story about Doc and Danny begins?
And so that is sort of thing, because did you know you were going to do that with Doc and Danny, or were those the stories that started coming? Because if we talk about 15 years, Greg, mm-hmm. they might have come at different times.
They did, and they came all out of order. But these particular characters kept coming back, sort of like a recurring dream. They were who I wanted to write about, sort of again and again.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll be back. Today on Living Writers, Greg Schutz is here. I'm T. Hetzel. You've got Living Writers. We'll be back. Just tuning in, you're just in time because today Greg Schutz is here on Living Writers. His book out with the University of Massachusetts Press winner of the 2024 Juniper Prize for Fiction, Joy Riders. Stories. And we've been talking about stories. And this is, it's been a joy to talk about stories with you, Greg.
Thanks.
Before we go, before we get back to the conversation, would you mind reading from Joy Riders and set it up for us?
Yeah, I'd love to. So what I'm going to read today is actually a very short but complete story, what's sometimes referred to as a microfiction, a story in under 500 words. And it's the story or the microfiction that closes the collection and in some ways I think contains within it then a lot of the emotional notes that have been touched upon earlier in the collection.
When did you write this story?
This would have been, I want to say 2020. This would have been, I think, early pandemic days.
So you wrote other stories after it?
I did. I wrote, and we can get into this a little more, that I was writing microfictions at the time as a way of sort of recovering my creative process after a long sort of drought period. And so there were still, I was sort of working my way back toward writing. You know, we've talked a lot about how short the story is, but it seemed too long for me to actually write at that point in my life. I was working my way back toward it. So there were a couple of full-length stories that I hadn't yet written, but that I would, and it would make it into the collection.
And it's interesting that you say, Greg, that this is like in the structure of Joy Riders, how this becomes the end note, though. It is interesting. And thanks for picking one that we could hear the whole story, like we've been talking about today, the importance of like the world that the short story can contain.
And absolutely.
This one in under 500 words.
Yes. All right. So the title is Not for Nothing. The last hinge of heartwood splintered, and the tree, a 100-year-old chestnut cankered with blight, groaned over into the arms of its neighbors, where it was caught and cradled and lifted. The whole thing rotated in a way he hadn't expected, and he barely had time to toss the chainsaw aside before the trunk rolled from the stump and came down across his lap. It drove him once firmly into the earth and bounded back, shivering on the elbows of its broken branches. He was 64 that spring, arthritis in one shoulder, a widower. He owned 20 acres off Pinnabog Road, boarded horses, sat up some evenings with a handle of Canadian Club. Last week, he had called the brother he still kept in touch with and made an unusual comment about his life. How it had long been a matter of settling for less and settling for less, making his peace with each settlement until, finally, recently, he had made his peace with settling for nothing, as everyone had to in the end. A long silence from the brother. They were not philosophical men. Should I worry about you? His brother had asked at last. He dragged himself as far as he could. Halfway across the pasture, his shoulder locked up, the pain far brighter and more immediate than the distant, dull throb from his ruined legs. He had glanced at them once before beginning to crawl. What he had seen had put the taste of metal in his mouth. He closed his eyes now, cheek to grass. One of the horses approached eventually, curious, stepping all around, an old bay warm blood with a sweetly pinkened nose. He could feel the soft earth, pressed down by her hooves, rising beneath him in response. A young couple, out for a drive, found him. Glorious spring morning, the black bogs shining, a lone horse poised in its pasture, keeping watch, it seemed, over something in the grass. Not yet, he had told his brother, and later, much later, learning to walk again on legs braced and caged, he caught himself by his armpits between the parallel bars at the physical therapist's office and felt the urge to rise suffuse him, as though forced on his body from a place beyond the pain. But from where, he wondered, and why, if not for nothing? And shook himself to tears with laughter.
Thank you, Craig.
Thank you.
So, with this moment, Not for Nothing, that title is just, it feels so hopeful. with its double negative.
It does.
But the story itself is intense, isn't it? And far reaching, as well as different characters being introduced. There's multiple notes being played. But yes,
I'm so glad that the that hopefulness shines through. That I think these are, in many cases, these are dark stories. They are not, I think, in any of their cases, hopeless stories. That these are all stories, I think, that are they work. They find light by finding the shadow, right? They find what is, they find those areas of darkness, of loneliness in a lot of these characters' lives, and by contrast are able to locate these pinpoints of light in those same lives.
I think one of the moments that was so strong to me was in the early, maybe the first three or four lines, where it was unexpected how it fell back on him and then he was across it as well. Am I getting the image right, Greg?
How it rolled off the trunk and came down across his lap?
Yes.
Yeah, it's a really good example maybe of an instinctive sort of move working well, that I had written this first line that I had liked, in which the tree as it's cut down is caught and cradled and lifted. And then from that moment, I had this opening image, it was almost as a prompt to work with, that falling and being lifted became the pattern of the story. The tree falls on him and lifts itself on its broken elbows, right? He lifts himself and drags himself. The ground rises beneath him as the horse's hooves press it down, and ultimately he is able to fall and lift himself again as he's struggling to walk once more.
And with the parallel bars where you're trying to lift just to move forward.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. So it's one of the lovely things I think about writing a microfiction, is that if you have that opening line, if you have that opening image, if it feels resonant to you, contains within it, right, the seeds of the rest of the story. That image is just about iterating it and expanding it a little bit, or finding out maybe by doing so why that image felt emotionally powerful to you in the first place.
And how often do you feel like you have those kind of lines, Greg?
I think I need them quite often, that I'm not very good at outlining a story. I'm not very good at planning my way through a story. That my way through a story typically, it's a lengthy one, that there are stories in this book that, took multiple years to compose. So it is something I do by feel, and one of the places that feeling comes from, right, are those lines that surprise a little bit, that I like, that I'm fond of, but not for reasons I can necessarily describe, that I try to trust in those moments that the reason this line feels right, or the reason I love this line but I can't tell you why, is because it is connecting to something that is like the source of the material for me, that is the source of the story. It's connecting to whatever it is I, on some level, want to get out.
Yeah, and that you don't know yet. Well, you might have a knowing, but you have a not knowing that keeps you going.
Yes. The writer Patricia Hampel, this wonderful, wonderful, I think of her as a wonderful memoirist. She has this essay, Memory and Imagination, that I teach to my students in English 325, which I teach as a memoir writing class, in which, among other things, she describes the act of writing, and especially revising a memoir, as an act of self-psychoanalysis. What was it about this memory? What was it about this event in my life? Why am I drawn to it? Why did I write it this way? Why did I choose that detail over the other? Why was I not fully honest there? Right? Mm-hmm. The act of getting the essay right about that lived material is requires one to do a lot of the work of psychoanalysis. And honestly, that really resonated with me when I first read it in her essay. It resonated with me. It gave me a way of describing what feels like my process for writing fiction, that if a story feels alive to me or feels like something I need to be working on, I kind of trust that it's because it connects in some way to something about me. Or maybe another way of putting it is to, I described Doc and Danny as these like recurring dreams, right? They kept coming back to me. And I think that's that one thing that is, you know, in one sense sort of obviously true, but is also, I think, often underappreciated, is this sense that all of your characters as a writer are you. Just like, you know, say all of the people, all the figures in your dream are, in a dream you have, they're all you. They're you wearing different masks, right? And I think that's true in a work of fiction as well, that all of these characters are me, or they have something to do with aspects of myself, or I put myself in their points of view as ways of examining ways I have felt in the world. And as soon as I, experience has taught me, as soon as I know why I'm doing that, as soon as I could tell you, this is why I'm writing this story this way, this is how it connects to my own material or my own lived history, at that point, the story kind of goes dead to me. I have so many half-finished or even pretty much finished stories that just don't matter to me in the right way anymore, that writing a story then is a little bit like, a little bit like lucid dreaming, right? That if you try to control it too much, you will wake up. You're trying to pull it along in a certain direction while it is also revealing to you moment by moment all of these things you couldn't anticipate, but things that you must trust do, in fact, come from you.
Can you work on, then, it seems like more than one at a time? Like, do you have these... Because I almost like we've been, I've said a couple of times, like these open worlds, you know, of or the world of the story. Yeah. So then technically they'd be these open worlds. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And as a human being, we are, that's how we're living. We have these parts of ourselves that are coming, like not coming and going, but growing and mm-hmm, in some stasis, et cetera. Is that how, when you, what's your desk like? Or is that how the stories are like for you, Greg?
Yeah, well, my desk is an absolute mess. It's down in the basement, and it's beside my workbench, which is usually covered in tools and fishing equipment, which often then sort of migrates over onto the writing desk. But yeah, I do have to be working on multiple stories at once. I've mentioned that sometimes it takes me a couple years to get a story to where I think it's finished. I think I would go... I'd go a little bit batty if I had to stick with one story for that long, that... You know, it's kind of just a matter of following the impulse. When I sit down, you know, for a writing session, I usually have a sense of the various sort of irons I have in the fire, which one feels kind of fun to work on. And it is. It's fun, right? That if it's not, why would I do it? So I don't know. I follow the energy in that way. I follow what's fun on any given day, which is, you know, perhaps saying that maybe that's another reason that sometimes it takes so long to finish one thing is because I am, I'm jumping around, I'm changing horses midstream for months and months at a time, day to day.
And do you have some stories that you're working on now, too?
I do. I have some of them are stories that simply weren't ready in time for Joyriders. Some of them are, in fact, more Doc and Danny stories. These are people who I feel very close to, very tender about, and can't seem to quite get to the bottom of.
This is interesting. So not to get too far ahead of ourselves, but then there could be, at some point in the decades ahead, a reissue with all the Doc and Danny stories. And it seems to, it's reminiscent of how Charlie Baxter sometimes works.
Saul and Patsy, yeah, especially. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. I love those stories so much.
Okay, let's take a short break and then we'll come back. We'll talk more today with Greg Schutz, his book of stories, Joyriders, on the table with us. Oh, and I'll do a quick thanks to Chelsea Harris at University of Massachusetts Press for sending a copy of Joyriders my way and making this happen. And thanks to The Rev, it's making us sound good today. We'll be back. Welcome back. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel. Today on the program, Greg Schutz is here. Joy Writers Stories, out with the University of Massachusetts Press and winner of the 2024 Juniper Prize for Fiction. These stories, Greg has been telling us, were a long time in the making, but they're worth waiting for. And it's so cool to see them here in this collection, your debut collection.
Yes. Oh, it means a lot to me. The first time I held the book in my hands after so many years, that was a very special moment.
Was it when did they send you like an ARC to proof, or was it when you got a box of books in the mail, Greg?
Yeah, the first proofs I saw were all PDF files. So I happened to be down at the local bookstore in Chelsea. The wonderful Serendipity Books. Shout out to them. And I was going to be doing an event there for the book, and so they had, the bookstore owner, Michelle Tuplin, had an ARC, had a reader's copy, and let me see it. And that was the first time I held a physical copy of the book in my hands. And I had to, in a very public place, I had to play it very cool. But it was this really, really moving moment.
Because there is something about Because like we said earlier, these stories had found different places in the world and different journals, but together.
Yeah. I think, in part, to sort of circle back to one of the thoughts we began with, I mean, it is hard to sell an individual story collection. And a number of times I had spoken, say, with agents, or I had spoken with people who worked at publishing houses, and the idea was always that these are great stories. Tell us about the novel you're working on. And I wasn't. I was still felt and still feel very much consumed by the short story as a form. And so I had, in a way, sort of let go of – I don't want to say given up. That sounds too negative. I had let go of the idea that these were going to turn into a book. And I was okay with that. I was sending the manuscript, the stories together, out to various contests. And I, told myself, well, if it just comes back and nothing happens, that's that. And that has to be okay, because this is what you've signed up for, Greg. This is what it means, to write and really be devoted to the stories. And it feels like the moment that I actually legitimately felt okay with that, let go of that idea that it was going to be a book, that's the day I got the email. That's the moment I got the email from the University of Massachusetts Press, and it became a reality.
Wow. That just got like a bit of a chill there, too.
Well, I think it's connected to what I was saying earlier about having trouble for a period of time as a writer, that letting go of control, letting go of the outcome, was absolutely necessary for me. I was I came to the program again as right out of undergrad. I thought then, I'm going to write these stories in this program. It's going to be my first book. I'm going to go from there, shooting star, to the top of the literary mountain. And of course, that didn't happen. And the longer that didn't happen, the harder it became for me that I was someone who had I had never had an opportunity out in the world to build an identity other than writer. And so not succeeding in this public way as a writer became increasingly sort of painful and came to feel like an increasingly public sort of pain. Of course, no one was out there sitting around thinking, where is Greg's book? What is he doing wrong? I was thinking that. And it led to this point. I've said that writing for me, it has to be a kind of a form of play, right? It has to be something that you engage in sort of free of anxiety and open to whatever arises. And you have to, along those lines, then sort of admit all the various inefficiencies in the process that will arise as a result. And it became less and less a feeling of play. And the longer it took to get the book out, the better the book had to be to make up for the delay, right? Which delayed it further. And so eventually, I kind of got to a point in my creative life where I had to sort of fully hit a reset button. I had to try to build up that creative practice utterly from scratch. And it did involve a lot of letting go of a sense of who I was supposed to be, right? This public image of Greg as author that I myself had built up for myself became a kind of cage. And so letting go of that, finding my way back to fiction, first just by writing sort of fragments, writing sentences, writing microfictions, right? It started to spark something, started to feel playful for me. I started having fun again. And in that way, right, the book started to come together. So again, then it was just this this lesson in letting go that actually opened things up, that made things possible.
Thanks for talking about that, Greg, because that's something that feels like such, that is obviously such a real experience, and it feels familiar to me too. I understand, like, it's we have the life of a maker, and yes, and what you believe about what you're making.
Yeah, and just these tensions between, right? I mean, the making is this deeply private thing, and I think most of its satisfactions, its truest satisfactions, are, you know, at least in my experience, private ones. And yet there is this public side to the act, to the process, that if you let it, can sort of dominate that process in sort of an unhealthy way. That what has been lovely has been the opportunities like this today, right? Where there's this sort of this joyful entrance into the public sort of role of writer, rather than this sort of anxious one. That I'm so pleased by this book. It's a collection of stories. It's from a university press. They did wonderfully by me with it. It's exactly what I would want it to be. And with that, though, with sort of its with that is a certain kind of liberating, I guess, kind of smallness, which, you know, a freedom that comes from that. This is the book I wanted, and that feels so, I don't know, that feels so nice to me.
So valuable.
Yes,
it's a valuable book. Greg, earlier you said, and I think it's clear to everyone listening too, like the process for you when you're in it, you're so in it. You mentioned even about waiting, taking a different point of view to have the story unlock itself to get to the end. When you're drafting a story, for example, were you able to move past the scene with like the vet and the sheriff, or did you stay in that moment of the story because you didn't know where the rest of the story was going? Like, maybe I can use that as a pointed example question, but for your drafting process, how do you get to the finish line? Because we've talked a little bit about beginnings.
Yes. I think it's probably the case that every story has its own sort of process, right? That every story is sort of written for me. There's one story in this collection that I sat down and I just sort of started writing, and over the course of 3 days, it just kind of came onto the page, and it needed only fairly light revision until it was in published form. But that is...
Which story was that, Greg?
That is the one titled To Wound, To...
To Wound, To Tear, To Pull, To Pieces.
To Wound, To Tear, To Pull, To Pieces. Yeah, so that it just kind of was there, right? And that was this wonderful gift. That's also, for me at least, that's lightning in a bottle, and I've not been able to capture it again, that my process is typically nonlinear. You know, for instance, once I wrote that scene with Doc and the deputy, I had to go back. I had to write, well, how did the deputy get to this point, right? Why did he seem to react sort of negatively or suspiciously toward Doc, right? And I had to sort of build up his night and to think about not only that, but the life he was leading coming into that night. And so from there began to get enough of a sense of him as a person that I could start carrying his story forward as well, and to think about how it might continue to sort of intersect and braid with Doc's story.
Do you ever, when you revise, are you also, because you talked about cutting down, cutting back, but so many of your lines, they feel so precise in the detail, like that things are. Is that, because that's pressure too?
Yes, yeah. a lot of composition then happens for me on the level of the sentence that I was just talking about, sort of these stories are sort of with this sort of a bird's eye view. But really, when I'm sitting down to write, what I'm mostly thinking about is the sentence that I'm working about. What, you know, rhythm feels right, right? What details, what sort of, you know, yoking of adjective to noun is sort of produces that little burst of pleasure in me, right? And how does then the next sentence begin to take its shape out of the sentence that I just wrote and feel satisfied with? You know, it's, again, an inefficient process because I may go back and then revise and change all those sentences multiple times, but I feel like I need to have something about the feel of one sentence established before I can go on to the next sentence, that they do sort of rhythmically grow out of one another.
So in effect, you are letting go often all the time in your practice.
Yeah, I think the trust is then that simply by following these words and the rhythms of the language, I am going to get at something about these characters and their lives and how they feel and how it feels to experience their lives along with them, that the emotional effects will accrue.
And so, Greg, for looking for your next story, what story are you in right now? Or is it you don't want to talk about it?
I've got a couple stories in the hopper, but the other thing I'm working on, the thing that's sort of been grabbing me lately, sort of following the energy in particular writing sessions, I've been working on what I might describe as a book of eco-craft / memoir, sort of touching upon what has always felt to me something that is true but has been really difficult to talk about or explain, which is the ways in which writing and angling for me are parallel practices, are ones that I engage in for similar purposes or engage in very similar ways. And so I've been sort of exploring that a little bit in a couple different essays.
And that also makes sense because it's connecting in with your 325 class that you mentioned.
Absolutely. I, in fact, sort of started writing these in part because I'd been assigned 325 for the first time and I didn't know what to do. I better learn a few things about the memoir before I start teaching it. And it's been this really wonderful kind of bruising process in the way that a good therapy session can be kind of bruising, even if you walk out of it not sure quite why.
Right. And the stories for you are so different, like the feeling of those, like fun, not bruising, but a deep connection of,
yes, I mean,
yeah.
Bruising maybe is wrong. Rubbed raw might be this feeling that a good writing session gives me, right? Because you've touched a live wire with those characters somehow. And I trust that if I can do that for myself, that energy is going to come through the text for the reader as well.
Well, I love it. Thank you, Craig. Thanks for talking today.
My pleasure, T.
And I can't wait to talk again. And
absolutely.
Thank you for these stories. Enjoy Riders. Joy Riders Stories, out with the University of Massachusetts Press. Everyone, today on the program, Greg Schutz. You can check out his website and head on down to your favorite local bookstore. Maybe it's Literati. Maybe it's the one in Chelsea.
Serendipity. Either they are both wonderful.
And thanks so much to Reverend Andrew for engineering today. Thank you all for listening out there. Hi, Mom. And I'm T. Hetzel. Until next time.
Announcing that this is station WCBN FM Ann Arbor, your Dharmic free speech station.